ultimately the real reason was the members were asleep at the wheel. You know, nobody was paying attention. And it was a big river of money going by.
Dwight Brown was the CEO of the Cobb Electric Membership Corporation, an electric cooperative outside of Atlanta, Georgia. From the late 1990s on, through shady subsidiaries and outright theft, Brown cost his cooperative nearly $400 million, including funneling more than $21 million of member money into his own pocket. Brown's deceit didn't stop with Cobb. He successfully convinced other cooperatives to buy into a proposed $2 billion coal-fired power plant called Washington that would be contracted through his for-profit subsidiary. Through grassroots organizing, the uneconomic boondoggle of Washington and its sponsor were defeated. Brown was indicted in 2011 on 31 charges, including racketeering and theft. In the midst of this scandal, the nearly 200,000 member owners of Cobb EMC struggled to take back their cooperative. Mark Hackett, president of the Cobb EMC Forum, joined John Farrell this week to talk about how an engaged membership continues to be essential to defending the vitality of a locally owned electric company. This is Local Energy Rules, a podcast sharing powerful stories about local renewable energy.
Now, you're as the president of the Cobb EMC Forum, you know, what role did you play in, you know, either the sort of uncovering or witnessing of the issues facing the co-op, and, you know, what role do you play now in terms of keeping members engaged with sort of restoring member control?
Well, I can't claim to be one of the folks that uncovered it and participated in that litigation, but I did participate in the effort to get a new board of directors elected. And there were really a number of organizations that were involved at the time. You know, members were forming little groups to try to get the situation corrected because it was such a public affair by that point. Two of those organizations were the Cobb EMC Customer Alliance and a group called Take Back Cobb EMC. And I first got involved with Take Back Cobb EMC back around 2010. Take Back Cobb EMC was funded primarily by some environmental organizations that were trying to stop a coal plant that was being planned for South Georgia. And the coal plant was one of the insider deals that was going on at Cobb EMC. Cobb EMC was the largest participant. They had gotten some other folks involved, some other EMCs in Georgia involved, but they were the largest participant. One of the executives at Cobb EMC was running the development company that was charged with developing the project. But the environmental groups were looking to stop the coal plant, and they felt that the coal plant was an economic boondoggle, which it was. So they felt if they just could get a non-corrupt board in Cobb EMC that the coal plant would fall apart of its own devices. And I got involved because I've got a 30-year career in the electric and gas utility industry. I was former head of power trading and generation system planning at Oglethorpe Power. I owned a consulting firm for a number of years that provided software and consulting services for planning in the energy industry after my tenure at Oglethorpe. And so when my wife got the call from Take Back Cobb EMC, they were cold calling folks. My wife says, "You want to talk to my husband?" and handed me the phone. So I got involved with them at that point. And part of the expertise I provided was helping to define the economics of a baseload coal plant to the Cobb EMC members and to the Cobb EMC, the new Cobb EMC directors. The economics were dismal. Cobb EMC had no business being involved in a coal plant of that size. And so, you know, the goal of Take Back Cobb EMC was accomplished. They got a new board in, and the new board, first thing they did was say, "Well, this is an outrageous boondoggle. It's just going to cost members a ton of money for no reason." And so they backed out of their participation. But then what happened was we got the new board elected, and so Take Back Cobb EMC kind of ceased to be a there ceased to be a need for Take Back Cobb EMC. Their mission was accomplished, so to speak, and the Cobb EMC Customer Alliance, much the same. Their mission was to get the new board elected. The new board was elected, so the remnants of those groups combined to form Cobb EMC Forum, and our mission is a bit different. Our challenge and mission is to try to encourage member involvement in the affairs of Cobb EMC so that we never revisit the sins of the past. And boy, it is a challenge, because it's amazing, once the stuff goes out of the news, people go back to their lives, you know? You're working hard every day, you pay that electric bill, but trying to be involved in that EMC is not high on most people's lists.
So was that, you know, given that, you know, there was a lot of attention with stuff in the news, you know, when the scandal was revealed, was it relatively easy to get the board replaced at that point? Did board members try to stick through?
Getting them elected, getting the votes wasn't hard. Getting the elections was hard, because Cobb EMC, while the litigation was ongoing, there was a huge battle about how the elections would be held. You know, what Cobb EMC was trying to do things to rig the elections. The plaintiffs were going to court to stop them from doing those things. So elections got delayed for several years. And the board members that were entrenched just kept their seats with no elections being held. Be that as it may, we did get a whole new board, and a lot was accomplished. I mean, the new board is miles apart from where we were in years past. You know, rates have come down. The corruption has stopped, as best we can tell. The new board has established a lot of principles in a new set of bylaws that are very positive and help ensure member involvement in the EMC, and more transparency than ever was had before. So a lot's been accomplished.
And so, you know, in this particular case, you know, with Cobb, you know, you ended up stopping a bad deal on a coal plant for members, and your former CEO is now going to court. But it sounds like you were saying that there are some attempts to undermine member control as well as part of this whole problem with the electric co-op.
Yes, John, it's just an example of why it's so important that the members of co-ops maintain their vigilance and stay involved in the governance of the company. Last year, Cobb EMC Forum had what I consider to be a great success. We had a situation where the board had made a great move to open board meetings to members of the co-op. So any member of the co-op can go to the regular monthly board meeting and listen to the proceedings. However, they did not open committee meetings. And over the last couple of years, as controversial issues have come up, the board had started to take the tack of having committee meetings attended either by the vast majority of, or even the entire board, where they would hash out all the difficult and controversial issues in private, and then they would bring the item to the monthly board meeting that members could attend and basically say nothing. They would say, the finance committee recommends such and so. The chairman would say, is there any discussion? And there would be no discussion. All in favor, aye. Everybody raises their hand. And so the issue gets passed with no discussion, no understanding by the members of what's really going on. And so Cobb EMC Forum, actually I, as president of Cobb EMC Forum, proposed a bylaw change in 2015 that said if a committee meeting has a quorum of directors attending, then that meeting will be treated like a regular board meeting and members can attend. And that went on the ballot for the members to vote on in September, and the board recommended a no vote on that bylaw change. The members overwhelmingly supported the bylaw change. It got about 58-59% of the vote, and that was the first time, to my knowledge, that a member proposed bylaw change has ever been passed against the board's recommendation. And we were feeling pretty good. We'd also had three other bylaw changes that were passed that in September that were originally drafted by members, but through negotiations with the board the members and the board came up with an agreed-upon language that the board then sponsored as a bylaw change and actually supported. And so with the three board-supported bylaw changes and the success on the bylaw change to open committee meetings against the board's recommendation, we were feeling like, hey, things are going pretty well. Well, come December, the governance committee proposes to change the number of signatures for a member to propose a bylaw change from 35 to roughly 850, effectively taking away any member's right to easily propose a bylaw change. I mean, you pretty much have to have it as your full-time job to create bylaw changes to go get 850 signatures. So it was a really big move to stop. It was clearly a reaction to the bylaw change passed against the board recommendation to prevent members in the future from proposing any other bylaw changes, say something to require reporting of the board compensation. You know, there's any host of things that could be proposed that would give the board some angst but actually help members control the COPOL. So the board proposed this action, and they were going to unilaterally pass this bylaw change to raise the number of signatures. This is even more nefarious because the member's right to propose a bylaw change is a right that's stated in what is called the Member Bill of Rights, which is a preamble to our bylaws. And the member at the bottom of the Member Bill of Rights, it says the board can't change the Bill of Rights. But yet the board was using a trick or a workaround. They weren't changing the actual right as stated in the Bill of Rights, but they were changing Section 10.01 back later in the details of the bylaws that said how many signatures you require. We, in a preemptive action, while it was still at 35 signatures, have submitted a bylaw change to put that bylaw back to where it was in September. And then in January, the board went on ahead and passed their change. So now we're sitting here heading toward next year's annual meeting with the board having effectively precluded future bylaw changes by members, but we have one last one hanging out there that will put everything back and give us the right back. And you know, oddly enough, they doubled down this month. The governance committee is now proposing another modification to Section 10 of the bylaws to change the number of votes required to pass the thing. They're changing it from a simple majority to a two-thirds majority of member votes. So they're basically using their unilateral right to change the bylaws to pocket a third of the votes, or almost a third of the votes. In our last election, we had 10,000 votes roughly, and they would pocket 1,600 extra votes by making this change. So it's a real disturbing development. We're very concerned about it, and it's just a great example of why members need to be right on top of things and staying involved.
So Mark, the publicity around the corruption from Dwight Brown and some of his cronies was in around 2010, is that correct?
Yes. It really came to a head in 2010. The original lawsuit was filed, I think, in 2007, and there was some publicity associated with that. And then over the period of the next 3 years, the publicity grew and grew. And ultimately, I think Dwight Brown was indicted. Well, it was around 2010 or 11.
And so, Mike, I guess what's fascinating for me about this is that, you know, how could the board so recently elected to replace that sort of corrupt system be so quickly and so in such a small amount of time be moving to restrict member participation that was really crucial to restoring the co-op to its right footing? It just seems appalling to me that this could be happening, and I guess I'm a little bit surprised to hear that you've got board members who would be willing to support these kinds of measures so soon after the, you know, corruption as a result of member disengagement was uncovered.
It has been pretty dismaying to me as well, John. You know, we when the new board was elected, I think I spoke earlier to some problems with there was a caucus called the Cobb EMC Owners Association, much like a presidential caucus, and they worked to sponsor some candidates, and there were some issues with how that process occurred, and so some of the candidates that got sponsored and supported were really what I would say were really part of the old organization at Cobb EMC. They were friends of the chief operating officer and such as that. So when we got the new board, we had some that were much more forward-thinking and in favor of transparency than others. And it's funny, as the board has gotten to know each other and been working together, it's almost, to me, I don't know, to something like the Stockholm Syndrome, you know, where people that get kidnapped tend to identify with their captors eventually. You know, the board has become very thinking, they have grown to think very singularly and not have a lot of debate, that they tend to all want to agree with each other. And it's almost considered to be, five of us believe this and you want to go out on a limb and say it's not the right idea, you're being bad, you know. There's also a part of the bylaws that we tried to get changed and failed that says two-thirds of the board members can remove another director from the board with a two-thirds vote. So six board members could remove any director. And the conditions under which they can remove them are very loose. The language is something on the order of, if the board member, in the view of the voting board, does something that is or may be injurious to the cooperative, which is a very loose piece of language. You know, you could almost say anything is could be injurious to the cooperative, like disagreeing with the other board members in public. So it creates a situation where, I think it's a little bit of a situation of intimidation, where if there seems to be a majority of the board leaning a certain way, then it tends to drag the rest of the board with them and really suppress dissent. But in the grand scheme of things, I'm just stunned that they have taken the steps that they've taken lately with respect to member bylaw changes. And if you look at their dialogue, the things they're saying, they're using a rationale like, oh, if it's so easy to propose a bylaw change, some small group of members could take over the co-op and do something really bad. And so we're just protecting the members against themselves. I mean, you know, they're not using those exact words of protecting the members against themselves, but that's essentially what they're saying.
Unlike the problem when a small group of members who have been elected to the board decide to run amok with the co-op.
Exactly. And there's another issue I'd like to point out, and that is I'm not aware of any situation in co-op history where a small group of members has taken over and made a mess. It's always been a small group of entrenched directors. So they're trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist. They sent out a survey with some pretty biased language trying to get drum up the idea that members really wanted to increase the number of signatures. So, you know, the preamble to their little survey painted some kind of major crisis that a small group of members was proposing these bylaw changes to wreck things and blah, blah, blah.
As these cooperatives became more metropolitan, you know, that they were serving rural areas that became suburbanized, that Cobb EMC, among other large cooperatives, you know, look a lot more like investor-owned utilities, but they're not regulated. You mentioned that some members think there's some state agency overseeing these entities that they're members of, and they don't even realize that it's, you know, their job really to be the regulator as a member. Do you think that means that it's not a good idea in the big picture to have suburban cooperatives, that it's simply too complex or they're too big to be member-driven? Do you think that it's means that you just have a lot of ways that you have to restructure things, like you were talking about the rules that got into place once the board had been changed at Cobb, that can make it possible for member engagement to manage a large organization like that?
You know, I don't really know the answer to that question. We haven't really seen any big move for formerly rural and now metropolitan electric cooperatives going private, so to speak, or going back into the investor-owned utility world to have a track record as to whether that makes things better or worse. I also don't have that good a sense of how big the problems are across the country that CobbEMC fell into. I suspect there may be more of that going on, but I certainly don't know for a fact. But I do know that it does take member involvement and groups like ours kind of drumming up the members to make sure things don't go south. It's too easy for a board, once they get elected and then people stop paying attention, to forget who elected them. And if they know that there's no chance that they're going to get kicked out and that they're going to just be reelected term after term with an uncontested, if, you know, there's not even an election if the directors doesn't have a contest, so they just re-up for another three-year term. That kind of complacency tends to make people misbehave. You know, that's just human nature. So, at CobbEMC Forum, our biggest single mission, we feel, is to try to drive contested elections. We send out mailers reminding people there's an election, that they can run for the board, that it's, you know, a big part of people's civic duty to make sure that that happens, much like folks running for city government or any other kind of local government. It's a real important thing to do. And I think if there's groups like that and there's contested elections, then it's fine. Because, you know, groups like CobbEMC, if they're properly run, can do a lot for their members. And they have lower overhead. You know, if you don't have the big regulatory process, your overhead is lower. And they can just implement things for the benefit of members without going through a lot of the hoops that some of the IOUs have to go through.
That was Mark Hackett, president of the CobbEMC Forum, talking with John Farrell, ILSR's Director of Energy Democracy. More information on CobbEMC Forum's activities can be found at cobbemcforum.com. More information on electric cooperatives and their opportunities and challenges can be found in ILSR's new report, Remembering the Electric Cooperative. That report and other local energy rules podcasts can be found at ilsr.org. Until next time, keep your energy local, and thanks for listening.